Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, the Chancellorial Chair, Professor for Innovative Teaching, Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages in the College of Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences at the University of California, Riverside. He's also Emeritus Professor of East Asian Studies at Princeton University and one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture and people. And he's translated many Chinese stories, writings and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protest in June of 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
Good morning, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
And Perry, the Chen Guangcheng's escape subsequent—I mean, it's not being confirmed by the U.S. government that he's holed up in the U.S. embassy, but that seems to be the case. I imagine this is a humiliation for China's police state and an embarrassment for the leadership on the eve of Secretary of State Clinton's visit.
Of course, it's an embarrassment, and doubly so because it's right on the heels of this other problem they've had with Bo Xilai, who was an up-and-coming crypto-Maoist sort of star in the firmament of Chinese politics, who suddenly has been accused of corruption, and his wife of a murder of a British citizen, and his fall, and so on. So it's a sort of a double whammy, these two events coming together. I don't think the people who helped Chen Guangcheng planned it to coincide either with the Bo Xilai debacle or with the Hillary Clinton visit. But as it happens, these things do come together. And yes, it's a big problem of faith, as we say in Chinese culture, for the negotiations that are supposed to happen.
But there is a precedent going back to Tiananmen, isn't there, with Fang Lishai, who fled to the U.S. mission in Beijing after the Tiananmen massacre, and he was there for about a year, and that enraged Chinese officials.
Yes, and I was the one who brought him to the embassy and audited the 4 hours of negotiations between the two top diplomats in the embassy and him over the pros and cons of whether to stay or not. And the issues then were actually quite similar. The diplomats made it clear that he could stay if he wanted, but that it would allow the Chinese government to tar him and the whole student movement as being mere puppets of the U.S. administration, which wasn't true, and of course he wouldn't want. And also they warned him clearly that they wouldn't know when he could get out. They cited a case of some nuns in Romania who had come to the U.S. Embassy and gotten stuck for 14 years. As it turns out, Fang and his wife were stuck for 13 months, but that too is a consideration. On the other hand, to turn them out was dangerous for the U.S. side, because if it were known, and it would be known, because I was with them for one, and also the room we were speaking in, they told us was bugged so that nothing we were saying was secret. So it would be known that they had been turned out, and if he had been turned out and then sentenced to a long prison term or even executed, then it would be terrible press. So I'm sure that the U.S. State Department now has that in mind, too, especially in election year. Do you want to have it on your record that you allowed this courageous rights lawyer? This man is really an impressive man. Be sacrificed. They don't want to do that. So it's a really tough problem for the administration to figure out what to do.
Well, little wonder the Chinese authorities have blacklisted you, Perry Link. Not only did you edit the Tiananmen Papers leaked by a high-level Chinese official, you took the leading dissident.
I was blacklisted before the Tiananmen Papers.
Right.
So they've never told me why I've been blacklisted,
right,
but it's more likely because of my helping Fang Lijie in 89, yes.
So, but they're clearly that's a precedent, and the difference, I suppose, now with Chen Guangcheng's being in the U.S. embassy, which is the assumption, he doesn't want to come to the United States, does he? I mean, he wants
to
stay in China.
No.
Yeah,
he
wants
doesn't. He's following the precedent here of Liu Xiaobo, the courageous Nobel Prize winner who is in prison now. And Liu made it clear, too, from the beginning that he would not accept exile. The Chinese government has figured out in the last two decades, really, that it's smarter from their point of view to exile these dissidents than to imprison them. Because when they go abroad, they lose their credibility, they decline, and they're not so noticed. But if you're a Nobel Prize winner in prison, or a blind lawyer who's saying, I want to stay in China and continue working for people's rights in China, you're much more of a thorn in the side of the regime. So I think, I don't know Chen Guangcheng. I met him in the mid-90s. I haven't seen him since then. I can't say for sure that he's as firm in that position that he will not accept exile as Liu Xiaobo was. But so far, it looks that way. He said through his friends that he doesn't want to leave China.
So again, I'm speaking with Perry Link, who is a professor emeritus of East Asian Studies at Princeton University. He's edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official. And in 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. We're talking about dissent in China very publicly with this latest defection. This dissident was under constant house arrest. The movie actor Christian Bale tried to visit him some time back and was turned away by the secret police, or not-so-secret police. Apparently
he was in house arrest by the local authorities in his county in Shandong. That's something different from the central-level secret police. My speculation is that the top in China are probably embarrassed at the way he has been treated down in Shandong, but they don't want to get involved in these local power holders holding the lids on their local areas, because the center and the provinces have a sort of understanding that we will let you do your thing in your area as long as you keep the lid on, and that's what the center wants. So part of Chen Guangcheng's fleeing from Shandong up to Beijing is not just to go to the U.S. Embassy, but to get out of Shandong. It is conceivable that the authorities in Beijing might take his side, as it were, and say, Shandong treated you improperly. I don't think that will happen, but it certainly could happen, because the authorities that were really after him and were mistreating him and beating his family and so on were the local ones in Shandong, not the central ones in Beijing.
But that leads us, surely, Perry Link, to what's happening here in terms of the face of dissent in China, the growing dissent in China. Much of it's happening at the rural and local level, and it doesn't involve students and intellectuals like Tiananmen Square did. But these are farmers and local merchants who are sick and tired of being mistreated by the local party, Communist Party mafia heads. And I take it, you know, that this is happening all across China, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's the big difference from 20 years ago, when the student movement really was young intellectuals and students. And the term human rights in the 1980s was so politically sensitive that people didn't use it in public very much. But by now, 23 years later, the term rights, quan in Chinese, has really seeped down, and ordinary people, including farmers, use that and say, we're supporting our rights, we're demanding our rights. So that the percolation now is much more from the very bottom up than it was 20 years ago. And the main puzzle for so-called dissidents, the people like Chen Guangcheng and so on, is how to take their sophisticated understanding of politics and law and hook it up with this vast undercurrent of dissent that bubbles at the bottom. Most people at the bottom have complaints about the level of leadership right over their heads, the ones that are picking on them. And they have this idea, more or less, that if we could get to the top, then the top would take our side. And they petition. They go to Beijing, and they go to provincial capitals to petition, and they don't get anywhere. What they don't see at the bottom is that the top is just as bad, just as mafia-like as the bottom. And it's the challenge to people like Chen Guangcheng to try to get the rights consciousness that they understand in a more sophisticated way articulated well with the discontent that's percolating everywhere.
Well, nothing, I think, exemplifies the notion of the mafia at the top and corruption at the top than the recent scandals coming out of murder of a British businessman who was a kind of bag man or a business cutout for this wealthy family. And, of course, he was in the Politburo and he has tremendously, grand revolutionary credentials, doesn't he? His father was
really
a...
The scandalous part there, too, was that he had been wiretapping the very top leadership. Hmm. Hu Jintao, the top leader, was wiretapped by this Bo Xilai guy. Now, I can't say for sure, but I don't think that's unusual. I think those top leaders do... wiretap each other. In fact, they also record themselves. This is an interesting way to look at it. Top leaders, we learned this when we edited the Tiananmen papers, actually record themselves sort of the way Nixon did when he recorded his White House talks in order to have their own record of what the other person said and what they said. So this is not unusual. The top does treat itself that each other that way. They don't trust each other. It is more or less like a mafia culture. And this is exposed when the Bo Xilai affair comes along.
But his father was close to Mao, right?
Pardon?
Bo Xilai's father was close to Mao.
Bo Yibo, his father, was one of the party elders in the 1970s and 80s. He outlived Mao, but he was an original revolutionary.
So this gave this guy a lot of credibility with the party, but he sounds like he was as corrupt as anybody.
Oh, yeah, sure. And then the leader apparent who's coming in next year, Xi Jinping, is another son of an original revolutionary leader, too. These people are called... the Princeling Group, because they inherit the mantle of revolutionary credentials, although by now they've completely abandoned the original ideals of the revolution and are in it for money and power now.
Right, and the corruption is so extraordinary that you've got them all wiretapping each other. It makes you wonder, there must be all these different sort of divisions within the police apparatus with divided loyalties, etc. This doesn't sound like a system that can last for too long, particularly with sunlight being an antiseptic.
Yes, I think so. It's hard to predict when, but I have the feeling, too, that we're at the end of a dynasty here.
There's nothing a communist government fears more than a workers' revolt.
Of course, right. Ideologically, that's anathema, but in a more practical sense, it's just a constant struggle to keep the lid on. The budget for domestic spending on what's called stability maintenance a couple of years ago, in 2010, exceeded the budget for the military that's supposed to handle external threats. So that fact itself tells you where the top leadership feels that its biggest threats come from. It's from their own people, not from the outside.
But you were just in closing, Perry Link, you were saying earlier that the real dissent in China comes at the local level from peasants, farmers, small merchants who are oppressed by the local Communist Party mafia.
Right, and laid off workers, too, and yeah. Workers whose pensions have disappeared because in the work unit system in the Mao era and even the 80s, the post-Mao era, first decade, before the inflation got so bad, you could rely on a pension being something that you could live on. But now those pensions stay the same size while the economy booms and all of this whole generation of elderly people that worked their whole lives honestly through the work unit system of the Mao era have nothing to live on. That's a source of discontent as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
Again, Perry Link is a professor emeritus of Asian studies at Princeton University. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people. He translated many Chinese writings and poems, and in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform students' protests in June of 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link, and as he just mentioned, he was the person who brought the famous Chinese dissident from Tiananmen to the U.S. Embassy, where he was holed up for a year. Little wonder he's been blacklisted. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with the author, Robert Draper, of the new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do.